Well, I admire your stamina. Two seminars in a row. thanks for coming. So I want to tell you about some work that I started with Eugenio and that I've continued working on about the volume operator in loop gravity. So in particular, we're following up on this proposal of Bianchi, Donà, and Speziale that the node of a spin network should really correspond to a polyhedron in the semi-classical limit. And they proposed an interesting new version of the volume operator, which is just to take the volume of that node as the volume of this polyhedron. So the reason I say in the semi-classical limit is that these are really fuzzy polyhedra in a sense. They have quantum mechanical uncertainty. So I'm interested in this volume for three reasons, at least. One is that I think it's really a nice feature of the spin network basis that it has this geometrical interpretation. So it's nice that we can switch over from a sort of spin recoupling to a volume way of looking at things. I also think that studying the pentahedral case, the case with five faces, can help us learn about things like cylindrical consistency. So that's something that I want to talk about a little later on. And then finally, the case that Eugenio and I worked on was the tetrahedron. And the phase space of the tetrahedron is just two-dimensional. And the system is classically integrable. And so in a sense, it's too trivial. It's too special is really what I should say. And we need to understand something about the more general possibilities. So that's why I'm looking at this this pentahedral volume.
Why the volume has to be three-dimensional? You know, spin network have no dimensionality. So it could be five-dimensional, ten-dimensional volume. So why?
So I'm thinking of the canonical approach to gravity, loop quantum gravity. And so we think of spin networks as embedded in spatial slices. So I'm thinking of truly the three-dimensional case.
Spin networks. I thought spin network just on each link you have a J. It's a kind of graph.
Yes, absolutely.
So the graph can be, it can be any dimension as a
You can think of a spin network as an abstract graph.
Yeah.
And indeed, the spin foam approach and some of the more axiomatic approaches to loop gravity have taken that view, that it's an abstract graph. But the initial picture was one of embedded networks. Yeah.
Just to justify that old-fashioned point of view, if you think of it as derived from a quantization of the classical theory, then the connection of the manifold of the classical theory is not dynamical and becomes part of the operator algebra. And as you said, you don't have to think about it like that. You can just think of the graphs as combinatorial in many cases. But then you lose the claim that this is a quantization of the classical theory.
I see. So this is spin network is more like a triangulation for three dimensions.
The dual is like a triangulation.
And I'll speak much more about the dual, so we'll start to hear about that.
To answer the question about three dimensions, where is it's coded in the group, SU2. It is rotations in three dimensions, not in any dimension. So you add the SU2 and then you do that triangulation, the modes are for valent and the tetrahedron. But you get three dimensions as far as I'm sure, also for things that are not just.
Just adding on what he just said, so it's really because we're using SU2 and so it's SU3 intertwiners. But it would also prove that the space of SU3 intertwiners is simply the entropy space of entropy functions over the set of body address in three dimensions. So it's really fixing what the question is.
My outline today is I want to introduce the pentahedral volume. This has not been studied before, so I actually have to build it up. And because I'm building it up, the tetrahedral case is a nice example So I'll just go through that quickly. I know many of you have seen it before, but I want to review it because so many of the structures are parallel. Pardon me. So the pentahedral setup and then I want to talk about chaos and quantization. Eugenio instructed me that I was not to assume any background in chaos, so I'm going to give a brief introduction. And I'm going to do it through the process of quantizing chaos. This is fun for this audience because Einstein actually played a big role in understanding this. So I'll tell you a little bit about that. And then finally, I want to tell you about the volume dynamics of this pentahedral volume and see what connections we can make with quantum gravity. So let's start. So this also gets to this three-dimensional question that was just asked. So it's important that I'm working in three dimensions, and I'll assume that throughout the whole talk. And there's a classical theorem due to Minkowski, which is quite beautiful, that says that the area vectors of a convex polyhedron completely determine its shape. So the theorem says that given a set of area vectors that sum to zero, I'll call this the closure condition, then there's a one-to-one correspondence between that those vectors, which I've drawn here as a sort of porcupine figure, and convex polyhedra. These area vectors have directions that are normal to the faces of the polyhedron, and their magnitudes are equal to the facet areas.
Does this mean that the edge lengths are determined?
Yes, I'm going to give the edge lengths. The edge lengths of the... Of the vectors? Of the polyhedron. No, not until you've done the reconstruction. So this is a really important point to emphasize about this theorem. It's only an existence and uniqueness theorem. So it just says this polyhedron is out there. And it does not tell you how to actually build it. And as physicists, we're much, much more interested in having the polyhedron. They're uniquely determined, but you don't know them until you've done the construction. Yeah?
Is there anything in the spin network that says a polyhedron has to be convex?
That's strictly a part of the Minkowski theorem. So
if it's not convex, so I guess you don't have this one-to-one relationship.
That's right. So there's interesting polyhedra that are flexible that we could talk about, but it's a big side tangent. But to my knowledge, nothing about the spin network encodes that it has to be convex.
Do any set of vectors summing to zero have such? So it always disentangles.
Yep. Yeah, so Penrose has a wonderful intuition for one direction of this theorem. You put the polyhedron in water. We know that it's static, so the pressure is summed to zero, but the pressure is proportional to the area vector. So that shows you one direction. The other direction is much harder. I won't prove Minkowski's theorem today. Okay. So the work that Eugenio and I did was to focus on a tetrahedral grain of space. So we have four area vectors, and I'm going to fix the face areas. And the main ingredient is to turn this into a dynamical system. So you think of these vectors with fixed lengths, and that's like having four vectors that are on the surface of an S2. And we can then perform what's called a symplectic reduction. This is just a symmetry reduction. It's just like taking a cyclic coordinate and a Lagrangian and eliminating that variable. So when you do this symplectic reduction, you get a Poisson bracket on this phase space of S2 to the fourth, which is just the triple product bracket. If you're familiar with the Lie Poisson bracket, that is the same bracket.
From the perspective of Hamiltonian mechanics, a vector is both position and momentum.
So this is truly a Poisson setup, the way I've described it so far. So these vectors, a single vector is three components, right? So it's an odd dimensional phase space. So you can only talk about a Poisson structure. If you talk about it on the S2, then it's two variables and you have conjugate variables. Does that answer your question?
In this phase space, there are configuration variables in the momentum.
Yep.
What are they?
Good. We're getting there.
There's one thing that the constraint may not be satisfied. The sum of the four vectors may not be zero in this phase space.
So
you have an S2 for the fourth part. So that's a four arbitrary unit vector.
I didn't say it well enough. The symmetry reduction that I'm performing is overall rotations. I don't care how this polyhedron sits in space. So I'm going to, I haven't said it yet, but we're going to think of these area vectors as angular momenta, which makes sense with spin networks. And so as a generator, it generates overall rotations. So the symmetry that I'm reducing by is that overall rotations is equal to zero.
But this phase space, this S2 to the fourth power means you have means four vector. This A1 to A4.
Yes.
But the arbitrary configuration of phase space, the sum of A1 to A4 may not be equal to zero.
In an arbitrary case, it would be, but the phase space I'm considering is only the one where they do sum up to zero.
So you have a subspace of that.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so the topology of this reduced space is a sphere. So this is starting to get to your question, Matteo. And the coordinates on that sphere are the z height on the sphere, and it's given by the magnitude of the sum of a1 and a2. And the q coordinate is just the angle that's generated by that. As a generator, we know it, as an angular momentum, we know it generates rotations. And the q is that angle. So it's z height on the sphere and the azimuthal angle about the sphere. Yes?
What's the geometrical interpretation of q in terms of the initial vectors?
We have the closure relation. So we have four vectors that sum up to zero. Let me label them 1, 2, 3, 4 just for short. This P that I'm introducing is the diagonal, like this, the P is the magnitude of that diagonal. So the angle is, I want to preserve the closure condition, just as was being asked, and preserve the face areas, right? How can I do that? I can do that by bending this polyhedron. So the geometrical interpretation of this angle is as the angle between the two planes spanned by these vectors.
And it's easy to check that this angle between these two planes and P are conjugated using the formula of Poisson structure that you wrote in practice?
Yeah, it's easy to check it with that formula. But again, the physical intuition is much faster. This is an angular momentum. We know it generates a rotation. That rotation is the conjugate angle, right? So this is immediate. Okay, so let me just give you some quick intuition about this phase space. A point of this phase space corresponds to a tetrahedron is my claim. How can that be? Well, I fixed the four face areas. So I have four given variables. But I could determine a tetrahedron by fixing six edge lengths, right? So I know I need six data in total. So I'm giving four face areas, and I'm giving this P, which is like a dot product between two of those vectors. So it's like a dihedral angle in the polyhedron and the conjugate angle. So those really do determine a classical tetrahedron. Okay, so the idea that Eugenio and I pursued was to specify a Hamiltonian on this phase space, which was just the volume squared. So it's a fun and not difficult calculation to just check that the triple product of three area vectors is proportional to the volume of the tetrahedron squared. And so here, what I've shown is the contours of constant volume. Thinking of this as a classical dynamical system, these are, if I took an initial condition on right here, this is the trajectory that that initial condition would sweep out on the phase space. Okay, and then we bring in semi-classics. So we require the old quantization rule, the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization rule, that the integral of the momentum along this trajectory is equal to n plus a half times Planck's constant h. So this was the first introduction of quantized level sets. And in fact, these trajectories that I drew on this picture are the quantized orbits. So they're the orbits that satisfy that Bohr-Sommerfeld condition, and hence determine the quantized values of the volume. So just to put up the actual calculation that we did was that we found that that action is equal to a complicated function in terms of complete elliptic integrals. And so that's what we're actually solving for the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. Okay, so the exciting part of this work is that it works so well. So here I've plotted for given spins. The spins are related to the semi-classical areas by adding a half. And in this case, I'm considering a spin that's j plus a half plus a half. I'm sorry, j plus 1 plus a half. And we plotted the numerical exact diagonalization of the volume operator, giving the circular eigenvalues, and then the results of the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization as the black dots. And you can see that they agree remarkably well. So this gives us a new way of viewing the quantization of volume. Okay. So I don't want to linger on these results for too long, because I want to tell you about what I've been doing recently. But since Eugenio and I are putting out the long version of this volume paper, I thought I should at least advertise a little. So we noticed something that I don't think has been noticed about the volume spectrum before, which is quite nice, namely that there's an exact degeneracy in the volume spectrum. So if you look at tetrahedra with two different sets of face areas or sets of spins, so different intertwiner spaces. Here, 6, 6, 7, and 11 halves and 13 halves. The spectra agree exactly. So this is actually explained by the semi-classics and by a symmetry called the Reggie symmetry. So that's an advertisement to try and get you to look at the long paper. Okay, so I would like to do a similar thing in the case of a pentahedron. So let me first address the question of what is the volume of a pentahedron. If you look online, there's no given formulas, especially in terms of the variables that we're interested in, the area variables. So here's my pentahedron. I've labeled its five faces. And a simple way to come up with the volume is just to imagine scaling the three sides of this pentahedron such that it closes. So I'll call those three scalings alpha, beta, and gamma. So here I've drawn the resulting tetrahedron with face alpha 1, beta 2, and gamma 3. So it's remarkably easy to solve for alpha, beta, and gamma. We simply note that we know from Minkowski's theorem that the tetrahedron has to satisfy closure. So I take this closure condition, and I dot product it with A2 cross A3. The middle two terms fall out, and you get that alpha is equal to this negative ratio of these two triple products. Yes?
What if the pendant hedron doesn't close?
Good. This is a fiducial assumption. I'm assuming these adjacency relations and that it does indeed close. It's going to turn out that the ones that don't close are actually a very small special subset.
Measure zero.
So I'm not too worried about it. Okay, once I know alpha, beta, and gamma, I can simply use the fact that the pentahedron is this large tetrahedron minus the small dashed tetrahedron. And that gives me an explicit formula for the volume in terms of these area vectors. Excellent. That gives me the volume. But as I was saying to Lee earlier, there's an important facet of the Minkowski theorem, which is that we actually need to construct these polyhedra. And in the original paper of Bianchi, Dona, and Speziale, they went through a lot of work to actually do this numerically. And it's clear that it's not a trivial problem. And so the question is, why is Minkowski reconstruction difficult? The issue is that we don't know the adjacency of the end polyhedron. If you just hand me these vectors, I don't know whether these two vectors are going to end up describing faces that are adjacent to one another. So it turns out that the most difficult part is finding this adjacency. Once you have the adjacency, actually, you can explicitly find edge lengths and vertices and construct the whole polyhedron. So a remarkable side effect, as I'm saying here, of introducing these alpha, beta, and gamma parameters is that they solve this adjacency problem in the case of the pentahedron. So I won't show you the full proof, but let me just give you a sense of how this works. Again, I take fiducial assumptions about closure. So I'm just going to introduce the shorthand that W is a triple product. And I'll take first the fiducial assumption that I'm scaling 1, 2, and 3 to close the pentahedron. Then I find what alpha and beta and gamma are in that case. Now I take a second fiducial assumption. I assume that A1, A2, and A4 are the sides that I scale to close the pentahedron. And you calculate alpha, beta, and gamma again, or their analogs. And what you see is that there's a nice thing. You can express these parameters in terms of each other. So I've expressed alpha 2, beta 2, and gamma 2 in terms of alpha, beta, and gamma. And we require that this is a positive scaling, namely that alpha, beta, and gamma are greater than 1. So if this first one is constructible, then the second one is not. I'm not going to be able to scale it to close with a parameter that's less than 1. So this means that these two are exclusive to each other. And that's how these solve the adjacency problem. You check which cases are mutually exclusive and which are consistent, and you find the adjacency. So this leads to a phase diagram. So here again is my fiducial pentahedron. I'm going to call the various classes. So when you have, you only have two opposite faces, the two triangular faces. And I'll call this a 5-4 pentahedron. So it's the two opposite triangular faces. And I'll always say the first one is the smaller face. So it's the one that gets eaten when I do the closure. So this main phase, the central region, is, let me say the axes. This is just alpha, beta space for a fixed value of gamma. The central region is where 5-4 is constructible. And then you can see that in other parts of the parameter space, other configurations are constructible. So for example, down here, a pentahedron with 1 at the top and 3 at the bottom is constructible. Okay, so already we can say something interesting. So let me say just briefly what cylindrical consistency is. It's this notion that smaller graphs and their associated observables are completely contained within larger graphs. So in practice, the way we implement this is we take, say, a spin on this larger graph, J, and let it go down to zero. And we get the smaller graph that has that edge removed. What we can see already is that cylindrical consistency is implemented in the Minkowski, in this polyhedral volume proposal, but it's done so in a non-trivial way. So this was, I think, part of these authors' goal. Let's get a cylindrically consistent proposal for the volume. And this kind of comes as a surprise that it's non-trivial. So let me explain why it's non-trivial. If I start with this face 5 and let its area go to 0, it's sort of geometrically obvious that it limits to a tetrahedron, right? But if I start with face 2, you might have some concern. As I scale face 2 down, if I took it all the way to 0 and it stayed in this adjacency region, we would have this weird degenerate configuration, right? But instead, what happens is that scaling, decreasing the area of face 2 changes the alpha, beta, and gamma parameters. And they do it in such a way that you cross an adjacency boundary well before this area goes to 0. So you actually cross into a region where 2 is the smaller triangular face and 1 is the larger triangular face. Now you can continue to take 2 to 0, and you limit perfectly to a tetrahedron. So indeed, this Minkowski polyhedral volume properly limits and is cylindrically consistent as you take an area down to 0. And this is a non-trivial consequence of the Minkowski theorem. OK. So let me tell you a little bit about chaos and quantization in order to lead up to describing the chaos in the pentahedral case, potential for chaos in the pentahedral case. So I already mentioned this old Bohr-Sommerfeld rule. This was an invention of Sommerfeld and Epstein's, and they were building on what Bohr had guessed for the Bohr atom. And in fact, they developed this to the point where they could treat systems with multiple degrees of freedom, let's say d degrees of freedom, but only in the case where those degrees of freedom were separable, where you could separate the Hamiltonian and basically just look at the quantization of each of the variables separately. So this remarkable paper of Einstein's from 1917 explains that he was not satisfied with this quantization condition. And the reason is pretty obvious. It's if we make a phase-based change of coordinates, these conditions won't be invariant under that change of coordinates. And we won't be able to apply them anymore. So it's speculative, but he's just coming off of having thought about GR. So invariance under change of coordinates is a big deal. And so he started working on this quantization condition. So let me explain what he did just through examples. Here, I'll focus on a central force problem. And what I've plotted here is just the configuration space. So I'm going to consider 2 degrees of freedom. And as we know, for a central force problem in 2 degrees of freedom, you have an inner radius and an outer radius. And if the potential is very special, then you get closed ellipses for harmonic oscillator or Kepler problem. But in general, you get precession of the orbit. So what Einstein noticed is that in the configuration space, these trajectories cross each other. And I should really say a single trajectory will cross itself, right? And it seems like a very trivial observation. But he says, well, an easy way to distinguish what's happening is to just look at the velocity along that trajectory, or equivalently, the momentum. So this causes him to think about this trajectory in phase space rather than in the configuration space. And we see that we can just think of these momenta as coming from two sheets that cover the configuration space. So these are the two sheets of the torus that, when you project them down, collapse into the configuration space. OK, so this is a very simple observation, but has profound consequences if you consider the quantization. Because what he's going to do is he's going to consider quantization up in this phase space rather than on the configuration space. So following Poincaré, he was thinking about the fact that the sum over all of your degrees of freedom of PIDQI is invariant under phase-space transformations. And this, the topology of this torus is going to be invariant under phase-space transformations also. So the invariant way to express the quantization condition is to think about this line integral around a cycle of the torus. Rather than following the dynamics, you can just go around a cycle of a torus, and you can impose the quantization on that line integral. So you get as many quantization conditions as there are independent cycles on your torus. So already there, I would have been very happy with that as a result of this paper. But his real insight goes much deeper. And it's related to this very simple observation about different velocities on this trajectory. By the way, there's only two here. Because it's a central force, we have a conserved angular momentum, right? So we're only going in one direction around this annulus. So for example, the harmonic oscillator actually has four. And the torus sits above the configuration space in a more complicated way. So to illustrate his next insight, I'm just going to use billiards. So we think of a pool table that has an unusual shape. So here, a circular pool table, for example, and then send a billiard ball bouncing around this pool table. If you take a circle, it's very much like an integrable system. The trajectory follows a very nice pattern, which never crosses within a certain radius and bounces off the billiard at the outer radius. And any time that the trajectory crosses itself, it has two consistent velocity vectors at that point. However, if you change the shape of the billiard, things change a lot. So if you go to a stadium billiard, which you can get just by cutting the circle in half and then opening it up, any region of intersection of a trajectory with itself gives you many, many possible consistent velocities. And what Einstein recognized is that his quantization condition would only work in the A case, not in the B case. The issue being that if we tried to lift this B case into phase space, we get a surface that is folding over itself potentially an infinite number of times. And there's no simple way to integrate around that surface. Finally, these C and D cases are just to illustrate that generically what you have is a mixture of the two. So in this quadrupole billiard, essentially just an elliptical billiard, for certain initial conditions, you get nice integrable type behavior, while for other initial conditions, you get this much more ergodic behavior characteristic of chaos. OK. So to talk about this more specifically, I'm going to briefly introduce a surface of section. So I'll restrict to Hamiltonian systems and to 2 degrees of freedom, just to talk about this in a very simple way. So for Hamiltonian systems, you have conservation of energy. So your four-dimensional phase space gets reduced down to a manifold of constant energy, which is just three-dimensional. In addition, if I specify that I'm only going to look at the phase space along, say, the Q1 equals 0 section, so I'm going to, I might as well take Q1 a constant. I'm going to look at constant E and constant Q1. Then I'm left with only 2 dimensions in my phase space. And those are coordinatized by my other 2 canonical variables, Q2 and P2. OK. if I pick an initial condition on that two-dimensional surface, let the dynamics evolve, and ignore everything that happens along the dynamical trajectory until it pierces my surface again, and then mark it with a dot. This is what's called a surface of section. So it's just a way of taking the dynamics, which is very hard to visualize in this three-dimensional manifold, and putting it on a plane. OK, so I want to tell you some results from chaos. Kolmogorov, Arnold, and Moser proved what's called the CAM theorem. In order to explain this, I need to tell you something about these tori that we introduced. So let me go back to the torus real quickly. So there's sort of two different types of motion that can happen on this torus. It's possible that the dynamics makes it such that you wind around one of the cycles an integer number of times in the same amount of physical time as you wind another integer number of times around the other cycle. That's called rational winding, and it results in periodic orbits, right? The trajectory winds around and comes back to exactly where it started. In contrast, it's possible for these two frequencies of winding to be incommensurate. Namely, their ratio is not a rational number, and we densely cover the torus by this single trajectory. So I'll call one a rational torus when it's foliated by dynamics that have rational winding, and the other the irrational torus. So the result of the CAM theorem says that if we start out with an integrable system, so here I'm picturing a kicked rotator, something that's like a pendulum but kicked around, forced, and it's integrable. So you see in this Poincaré section tori in cross-section. So I've got my phase-based torus. I'm taking a two-dimensional section through it, and it looks like a circle on this surface of section. So the bounded orbits form these tori, while unbounded orbits, where the rotator just goes round and round, are free there. So the CAM theorem says that if I weakly perturb this integrable system, then some of the tori break up and behave chaotically, while others don't. And the exact statement is that the rational tori break up first. So what I'm doing here is increasing the perturbation strength. On the left, we have an integrable system. As you increase the perturbation strength, many of the tori in the middle break up, and you start to see chaotic behavior in the surface of section, where you're just coming through the section all over the place. But some remain as tori. And then finally, as you increase it even further, you're down to very, very irrational tori. So a fun exercise is to understand why some irrational numbers are more irrational than others. So here's another example from a billiard. So this is the Limousin billiard, one that looks kind of like a kidney bean. You see something else that is quite characteristic. The tori that remain tend to form island chains, people call them, toroidal sets that surround other toroidal sets. So this is the sort of thing that I'd like to look for in the volume dynamics of the pentahedron. OK, so let me tell you a few more things about the volume dynamics. So here I'm drawing the same picture that Etero was asking me about in the case of the tetrahedron. I'm drawing the closure relation of the five area vectors. And I'm doing this just for the exact same reason, to explain what the phase-based coordinates are in this case. So we're going to be interested in two of these. Now, I want to still preserve this closure condition and the lengths of the vectors. So now I have two diagonals that I can bend the closure condition around. And that'll give me two different momenta in my phase space. And then the conjugate angles are the other two coordinates, the q1 and q2 of the phase space. So this means that the fundamental, and this is tricky, right? Because the five area vectors gives me 15 variables, right? So as a dynamical system, your first thought is that this has 15 variables. But the fundamental degrees of freedom, after you've reduced by overall rotations of this thing, are just 2 degrees of freedom. So it's a system that we could look at by looking at Poincaré sections. To give you a bit more of a global sense of the phase space, if we fix P1 and P2, we know that this is like coupling of angular momenta, right? So there's all sorts of triangle inequalities that we have to satisfy. So the allowed range of the variables in the P1, P2 plane is just the imposition of all those triangle inequalities. So it's some convex region, which I've outlined here. And then over each point of that convex region is the torus that's swept out by the 2 angles that are conjugate to these momenta. So these again, are the tori that we're interested in. OK, so why might we expect chaos? The point is that this volume that we wrote down is a highly, highly nonlinear function. If we look, remind ourselves what the definition of the alpha, beta, and gamma are, it's ratios of triple products. And then we already have a square root of a triple product. So we have all sorts, a big mess. So the point of saying that is that we're absolutely forced to do this numerically. Let me take that back. Eugenio and I looked for a second for things that might commute with this volume and didn't find anything. So I'd be interested if you did. OK. So here's where we use a nice feature that people in loop gravity have been using a lot, which is that these angular momenta can be lifted up into a space of harmonic oscillators. So these are just the spinner variables that it's considered a lot in Etera and Simone's work. So by lifting these angular momenta area vectors up into this harmonic oscillator space, it turns out that we are able to use nice integration schemes. These are called geometric integrators. And I just want to tell you 2 words about that, what those are. So old-fashioned numerical integration is very straightforward. It's called the explicit Euler method. You just say that the value of the vector field that you're interested in at the next step is what its value was at the previous step, your step size times the given vector field, the given thing that determines your vector field. So that's an explicit Euler, and it's very easy to compute. Then there's a slight modification of this called implicit Euler, where you say that the value of interest at the next step is the previous value plus your step size times your vector field evaluated at the step that you're looking at. This is more complicated because you have to solve some polynomial or functional relation for the un plus 1. The beautiful idea of these geometric integrators is that in Hamiltonian systems, we have both a q and a p to play with. And you treat the q and the p on different footing. So you integrate the q explicitly. That's the u in this here. And the p implicitly. Why would you do such a thing? Well, we know that. Is what a typo?
I don't know. You said the first line is supposed to be explicit.
So it's explicit because everything on the right hand side depends on un, which is the node. Yeah. Well, this one is implicit because b depends on vn plus 1. So we know that Hamiltonian systems have all these geometrical properties. They preserve phase space area and things like this. And what's wonderful about this symplectic Euler method is that it does this at the discrete level. It preserves areas when you do this as a discrete map. So this has much, much nicer properties. So that's the advantage of doing this lift into this harmonic oscillator space, is we know that that's a Hamiltonian system, which can be treated by one of these symplectic integrators. Okay, so I've implemented a symplectic integrator using the pentahedral volume as the Hamiltonian, and my variables as the, it turns out to be 30 harmonic oscillators. And you can indeed preserve the face areas to machine precision to 16 digits and the volume to 14 digits without crazy effort. Okay, so what do we learn from doing this numerical integration? One thing that's really interesting that we learn is that the dynamics moves across these adjacency regions that I talked about, that phase diagram. And it does so in a really interesting way. So let me quickly introduce a Schlegel diagram. You just take the polyhedron that you're interested in and you project it into one of its own faces. So on the left here, I've drawn a pentahedron. Remember, it looked like a triangular prism, right? And so I've just projected that triangular prism into the plane of the back face here. So here's the two side faces, the opposite triangular faces, and the outer square is the back face. The adjacency boundaries, so I started out with a 5-4 adjacency that I was showing in that phase diagram and showed a 2-1 adjacency also. The adjacency boundaries between the two turn out to precisely be the degeneration of this into another pentahedron, but a special pentahedron, one that has 4 triangular faces and 1 quadrilateral face. So when you're on the boundary between two adjacency regions, you're in a special class of pentahedra that's actually codimension 1. It's 1 down. A Schlegel move is when you combine two of the vertices of the Schlegel diagram into the special case and then split them back up in the opposite way. And this is precisely how the volume dynamics changes adjacency. It just, you follow the dynamics up to an adjacency boundary where it becomes special case, and then followed across, and it moves into the other adjacency region. So here I've just shown that on the phase diagram. This explains something nice, actually, about this diagram. If you do the counting, you find that I haven't drawn all the cases here. I've only drawn 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 regions adjacent to this 5-4 region. Well, that's because precisely only those 6 regions can be reached by a Schlegel move starting with a 5-4 pentahedron. So you can once you've moved into one of these regions, you can move into a different one. But from the 5-4 region, you can only move into one of these 6. Okay, so the other thing that I've written on this slide is the formula for the volume in these two different regions. And you'll notice that it's not the same formula. So this may or may not be a surprise. It was a surprise to me. It turns out that the volume of a pentahedron, when you just define it as that, the volume of a pentahedron, is not a smooth function in the mathematical sense of the word. It's only C2. It can only be agree up to certain derivatives because these are two distinct formulas, right? So you have to check, and what I did explicitly was check that the first derivative of these two formulas agrees on the adjacency boundary. The second derivative agrees on the adjacency boundary, but the third derivatives differ. So the takeaway from that is that we have a lot of advantages, cylindrical consistency, when we do this definition. But one odd feature of the definition is that the volume becomes only C2. Unfortunately, this is not finished work, so I can only tell you partial results. But here is a Poincaré section using the pentedral volume as the Hamiltonian. I've plotted it in the, as I said, in the phi2, p2 plane, the other conjugate variables. And this is a section of constant phi1. And you can see already that there are tori. So we can already conclude that this is going to be mixed dynamics. We haven't shown that it is chaotic or not yet, but it certainly has some tori. So at worst, it's going to be mixed. Just to explain the plot a little, here I've done 100,000 time steps to give you this very clear torus. But I also wanted to show that I wasn't faking you out, because it actually comes out to be such a good oval. Here are two tori where I've only done 1,000 time steps. So you can see that you're building up this tori dot by dot. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that this is for the phi in this range, but I want to show you the full section. So so far, I've explored that much of the section. So there's a lot of room for chaos beyond this torus. One thing that is quite interesting is it turns out that this case that I've integrated stays completely within the 5-4 adjacency region. So it's possible that we might get island chains by going to different regions. So let me give you some conclusions. The Minkowski reconstruction is solved for phi vectors. So this is something that we can use to explore other things about this polyhedral proposal. The polyhedral volume implements cylindrical consistency, but it does it in this non-trivial way where you have to use the Minkowski theorem. Classical polyhedral volume is only twice continuously differentiable. So this is a feature we have to understand if we're going to keep exploring this. One thing that I wanted to say about that that's actually quite interesting, if you look at these billiards, remember the circular billiard was integrable, right? And it was when we went to the stadium billiard that we got the appearance of a lot of chaos. Well, you'll notice the boundary is not smooth when you go to this stadium billiard. And that's actually a feature that people have explored a lot and is important for the introduction of chaos, is that the boundary of your billiard is not smooth. So it may be actually the fact that the volume is only C2 because of these different adjacency boundaries, that may be one of the reasons that you see chaos, if you see chaos.
Well, the one you called quadruple,
yeah.
That one's smooth.
So it's not an if and only if theorem. It's just an observation people have made. We're in a good position to explore the volume dynamics of the pentahedron with these numerical integrators. And hopefully I'll be able to tell you soon whether this is truly a chaotic system. I should make one comment about what this means for quantization. So as I said, the deep insight of Einstein's 1917 paper was that not only did he, following Poincaré, say there's going to be chaos, but he also said it's going to be harder to quantize chaos. And this has sort of played out. People have had a much harder time quantizing chaos. From the semi-classical direction, what I can tell you is that there is one tool out there that's interesting. It's called the Gutzwiller trace formula. What it gives you is the density of states. So rather than giving you the spectrum directly, it gives you the density of states. And it does it if you know all of the classically periodic orbits, those orbits that do close on themselves. So you can get at the density of states classically by looking at these periodic orbits. So that might be something interesting to study in this case if it turns out to be chaotic. All right, thank you very much.
trying to think about where this might be applicable to physics. And the volume is the Hamiltonian for gravity, assuming that we fix some time slice and we're thinking about Hamiltonian rather than Hamiltonian constraint. Volume is the Hamiltonian limit of the infinite of taking cosmological constant to the infinite. If you think about it that way, then you can think that I'm perturbing by the usual Einstein part of the Hamiltonian, the rest of the Hamiltonian.
Sorry, say that last again?
The whole Hamiltonian is a volume term plus a term.
Yes.
And could you imagine perturbing, imagining the cosmological constant very large, start with the genus very large, and do perturbation theory in the curvature term of the Einstein.
So the volume that you're thinking of is the four-dimensional volume, correct?
You caught me there, but I was thinking, I could think of fixed lines.
Right.
So then it would be the three-dimensional.
Yeah,
it's actually in the Hamiltonian, it's the three-dimensional volume.
You have a point there. If you were to do shape dynamics instead, and you had the cosmological concept dominated over all other terms, then you would precisely have the Hamiltonian. That is just the volume, just some perturbation.
This is certainly one of the things that I've been hopeful about. One of the questions Eugenio and I asked very early on was, what's the meaning of this conjugate variable to the volume, even in the pentahedral case? And we were sort of struck by the relationship with the cosmological constant and trying to ask that sort of a question. But I think the idea you propose is a good one, is to treat this as the curvature terms as perturbation, but I don't have any results in that direction.
The second question is more general. I've heard people say this, that it's hard to quantize chaos, but I don't understand what's meant, because you're presented a Hamiltonian system with P's and Q's and Poisson brackets. I know how to construct the Hilbert space of that system, whether or not there's chaos.
I guess what I mean more specifically in this case is it's hard to get the spectrum of a classically chaotic Hamiltonian. So usually when people study Hamiltonian chaos, they look at the distribution function on the spectrum, and they just study it, the distribution of level spacings. They study it statistically.
So is it possible that like the large random matrices, the Hamiltonian and chaotic systems have in some sense random spectrum?
That's a very good analogy to make. In fact, it's precise in certain systems. So that's what I mean. That it's hard to get specific information on the spectrum.
Okay, so now let me push something a little bit. We're very proud that we understand the new vertex amplitudes, the spin foam amplitudes. But if there's really chaos in the system, four simplex by four simplex, maybe the spectra of these operators really in some sense is random, and they could be replaced by just random matrices.
That's why I'm so excited about this work. I think it's really important to understand whether there's chaos or not, because it totally changes how we look at treating the theory. It makes us ask questions like that rather than trying to treat it exactly.
I have a very interesting question. It looks like here you want to use the area of a facet as a dynamic variable to describe the dynamics of a geometry of space.
Yes.
I don't know about this, whether at classical level, whether this is a totally okay. I don't know what I'm saying. Say, like, whether this area are kind of gating variable quantity, and by specifying the area, really gets space, with all possible curvature. And so basically, I try to understand whether those areas really. Include all the possible dynamical variable of the usual, say, Einstein gravity.
Okay. I'm not sure I can answer that last question, but what I can say that's precise, and I'm sorry, I jumped in at the beginning, in the middle of this story a little bit because we've been talking about it, but there is a nice relationship between the Gauss constraint in canonical quantum gravity and this area vector constraint. There's been lots of work on this, but the Gauss constraint in gravity in discretized variables is precisely the sum of the fluxes of the electric field equals zero. So that's the parallel that I'm leveraging.
I think it's about the classical level. Basically, usually in the quantum gravity, or in classical gravity, we have a matrix. Then you say, but the matrix is not gate invariant. So we model out of gate dependent things. And then the things ask whether using some errors to describe space geometry, actually that's the first one, like a gate invariant way to describe it.
If you think about an approximation that I said that,
yeah,
in which you imagine there's a triangulation.
Yeah.
And rather than varying the metric as a continuous parameter, you're varying the edge lengths of the triangulation.
Okay.
So that's called Regis calculus.
Okay.
And the question is, and there are people here who know this much better than me, I'm looking at them, you can take as the areas as the dynamical variables rather than the edge lengths.
That's an equivalent?
No, it's not. The areas is much more variable.
Area and more.
The areas, yeah, they have much more triangles typically than edges in your triangulation. So the areas give you much more variables.
So it means the area can be redundant variable.
Yeah.
Can I say this?
Yeah, it's basically the problem is that here for one polyhedron,
yeah,
we have kind of a one to one relationship.
Okay.
But then you want to glue these polyhedra together.
Okay.
And the problem is to get that matching, you know, the neighboring polyhedra match.
I see.
And usually this is not the case. So in a sense, you have more variables. If you work with area variables, you have more variables.
I see.
So you work with something more general than a triangulation.
I see.
Maybe
there's a macro field.
There are even more variables than, yeah, some different quantum configurations exist.